Doogie.
Sam.
Real Madrid, Liverpool and Newcastle are having peculiar seasons that definitely aren't going to plan. All three are still in the Champions League, but that doesn't mean these are happy clubs. What has gone wrong?
What is this Real Madrid? I have no idea who they are, what they are, how good they are. At some point, we got to start looking at the players. If you're not good enough to play for this club, get out the door. And I think we're leaning towards that direction very quickly.
The situation at Real Madrid is already worse than what we thought.
Liverpool are boring. And I used to love watching Liverpool play. This is one of the most boring Liverpool teams I've seen in the last 10 years.
He has to start in Gamora now. He's coming on and he's doing more in a short space of time than Gakpo's doing in 65 minutes.
Lots of people are being very kind to Etihad. Is this possible? He's taken them as far as he can go. He's done a brilliant job, but ultimately it's effectively run its course.
Yes, hello everybody and welcome to another episode of The Truth. I'm your host, Sam Tai. Back to form, literally. My back has recovered.
Good.
And on the keys, literally, Doogie Critchley, his laptop has recovered.
It's back, baby. It was a nervy few hours, but yes, last Tuesday it turned back on around 10:30 after a long sleep and seems to be back in working order. And yeah, it's delightful scenes. I'm in a very good mood. We're on 40 points, lads. Sunderland are, 40 points. We were already safe, but it's great to be there. Early March already. Did not deserve a thing from that game against Leeds. We were pretty dreadful. It was a terrible watch from both sides. We got pretty lucky with some of the officiating, but we take 40 points.
Yeah. Pascal Strike's strange dancing with his arms has come in. And I'll tell you what, there's a little catalogue, a mini catalogue of goals that are ruled out correctly that you just wish had stood. And whatever Anton Stack did to that ball, or maybe more accurately, whatever that ball did to Anton Stack and his family to produce that kind of revenge action, the way he hit that ball.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
That Joe Rodon just kind of like, it just smacked him in the head and it went on. I mean, I just wish that goal had stood. Not for any reason other than aesthetically, it was one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen.
It was beautiful as well. But yeah, given the injuries we had, Xhaka not being able to start, Mukiele being out, Robin Roof's not playing as well, Elborg did pretty solidly on his debut in goal. Luke 09, I don't know why he was man of the match. I actually thought it was pretty chaotic from him, but Alderete and Ballard were brilliant at the back, but we offered very little. And even the penalty we did score was ugly. But it's a big night for you guys as well, as we record this on Wednesday evening.
Yeah, timestamp here is about 5:30 Wednesday evening. Mm. So big night for Fulham, big night for Villa, big night for everybody that hasn't played just yet. Midweek Premier League games are very dizzying, aren't they? But let's bring in our producer. Typically, I take this time to compare him to the scariest thing I can think of. That's been the trend. And right now, the scariest thing I can think of is Aston Villa trying to create a good chance from open play. That's the sort of thing that drives you from behind the sofa. So here he is, the human equivalent of a laboured Morgan Rogers touch as he tries to do it all for the 20th time, or yet another senseless backheel from Emi Buendia handing possession to the opponent. It's Jack Collins.
Thanks, mate. I'll take any Emi Buendia comparisons, really. That's something I could get on board with, I think.
What about the significantly better player of the two that I just mentioned?
No, like, I play nothing like Morgan Rogers. Much more of an Emi Buendia type player, actually.
But of course, yeah.
It's good to have you both here anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Just before we dig in, a couple of things. One, if you hear knocking, sorry, someone next door is doing something.
Drilling some sort of something.
It sounds like they're hammering, like, the backboard onto a wardrobe or something. It's really annoying, but hopefully...
Setting up a darts board.
Yes, maybe. Or just throwing darts really hard over and over again. Who knows?
I think they're a Leeds fan.
If you hear it, sorry. We'll do our best to take it out if it becomes a problem. And let's just touch on last week's topic quickly as well, the relegation discussion. All three clubs that we focused on lost. Sign of the times, but that's why those three were in that discussion. That's why we focused on them. Also, just a note, I found it highly amusing that I spent a good portion of time talking about how West Ham had really improved defending set pieces. They conceded 3 of their 5 goals at Anfield from set piece situations, so thank you very much to, well,
it's kind of everyone.
Everyone, really.
Because they come up against the new set piece kings. Liverpool have scored 9 since Christmas. No one scored more. How about that?
Well, there you go. Stats everywhere. Good set piece stats everywhere. Right, we're going to discuss three clubs whose seasons have not gone to plan, which is the same topic as last season, except we're going to move our gazes higher up the table and go across Europe a little bit as well, because we're going to incorporate Real Madrid as well as some Premier League talking points. So we're going to do what we do best. We're going to identify bad situations. We're going to start blaming people and pointing fingers.
Let's do it.
Very much the ethos of the podcast.
That's what we do.
So let's start with Liverpool. Very rocky season.
Yeah.
We've mentioned it a few times on this podcast, but obviously the season begins with the passing of Diogo Jota last summer. Has an obvious major effect on the squad. We don't really know exactly how much of an effect, but we know it's pretty sizable for obvious reasons. So we've had a tough time talking about the season, really, and have a tough time talking about Liverpool's performance all season long, because you never know how much that's weighing on things. So we're starting off with the most difficult subject, but a lot has gone wrong for Liverpool here. Like, there's been a lot of things that have hit them. And I'm going to list them all off, or I'm going to list some of them off, because it's a very long list, and I'll probably forget.
We've got time.
Quite a lot of them. They had some good results to start with, but the performances were really obviously bad. Initially, it was described as a sign of champions, but I think in the end, we've come around to the idea that maybe it wasn't the sign of champions. It was.
I remember after about 5 weeks, we were like, I'm not sure how good Liverpool are this season.
Yeah, they'd won five in a row, but all their games were won late. I think it was the 83rd minute or later, they were all won in, which is a sign of something. People said it was the champions' DNA. I think in retrospect, it wasn't. It was a team kind of hanging on. Very up and down winter in terms of form. Isak broken leg, Giovanni Leone torn ACL, a mini Salah drama, then Salah went to AFCON, Konate took time out of the team because his father sadly passed away, they've had a massive injury crisis at right back, Andy Robertson nearly joined Spurs in January.
Yeah, that was random.
I mean, what the hell was that nearly? And Florian Wirtz had a really bad couple of months to start with, then really came into form, then got injured. Alexis McAllister's form has been really poor overall, Gravenberg looks overworked, and Endo's broken his ankle and he's out for the season too. You know, as you list it all off, you're starting to understand maybe why Liverpool are in this predicament.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it's probably best place to start is just what happened with Wolves on Tuesday night as well. I mean, there is the overall picture, of course, as well, but Liverpool conceded a 90th minute winner for the fifth time this season. That is so demoralising.
It's a Premier League record.
It's a Premier League record when you've tried so hard to either get yourself in the game or get ahead, to then concede all these defeats so late on. That really sucks the energy out of your legs when you are, I imagine, very physically and mentally tired because of the schedule, but also grief takes a lot out of you in physical senses as well. And many times you just don't have the same motivation to work as hard. And I do think that is overhanging the entire season. But it is interesting that as we sit here in early March, the complete flip of public opinion, particularly amongst Liverpool fans, I think online is where I mainly see it, against Arne Slot.
Agreed, yeah.
And how lost they feel and how they don't see anything improving despite the injuries, despite the other factors, and how turgid they often look in possession. Even for the final 15, 20 minutes last night, the game really opened up, but it didn't feel like there was any guarantee that Liverpool were going to win that game whatsoever. And if you give them five draws from those games they'd lost in the final few minutes this season, they'd be third on 53 points and they'd be six off Man City, who do have that game in hand tonight as we record this. But it's a much more sort of rosy picture going forward if they are with those points. And you look at even someone like Mo Salah, who did score last night. The drop-off in terms of not just numbers, which is so painfully obvious, which I'm sure we'll touch on, but just his impact across a game. He is so easily containable now. And he did score last night, but that was his first Premier League goal since November against Aston Villa.
It was a nice goal, but Jean-Ric de Bellegarde passed it to him.
Yeah, it couldn't have been more simple. And now to lose nine league games this season, they lost eight in the two seasons combined. The last time they lost more in a campaign was in 2015-16 when they finished eighth. And as it stands, finishing eighth is not totally out of the question as well. For context, Mourinho's Chelsea, that terrible year where that banner went up calling them rats, etc. Mourinho was falling out with Hazard and Diego Costa, etc. They finished 10th. They lost 12 league games that season. Liverpool were already on 9. David Moyes' Man United, that one half season.
Whoa, that was a...
Lost 12.
I thought you'd made a misstep in, but you know, you're right. He did manage them.
He did. Even Liverpool that year in 2021, where again they were defending their title when they ended up with, who was it, Nat Phillips and Williams as their centre-backs because Bruce their Williams, entire yeah. defence yeah. got injured. They lost 10 games all season in the league. Liverpool were already on 9
yeah.
as the champions, having spent, £400 million. It was unthinkable at the start of the season, Sam, that it would have gone this badly.
Yeah, the results have eventually become true to the performances we saw at the start of the season. I think, so the most agitated that I've seen Liverpool fans this season have been when, results are whatever, but when they've streamed out of Anfield in December, for example, and they've beaten Wolves, but they have stunk the place out in the process and should not have won the game. When they've gone to Nottingham Forest a couple of weeks ago and been quite clearly the lesser side, but got away with a victory. And, you know, they got stung by Harry Reid's amazing goal against Fulham in the 97th minute. But that was a game that Fulham, like, a point is the least they deserved. And it's like, it's happening over and over again. I think the big difference here is, last season, Liverpool shot out into two goal leads pretty quickly in a lot of games, controlled games really well because they were two goals up and they had that buffer, they had that cushion. And it's something I've spoken about with Aston Villa this season, which is as long as you are only one goal ahead of your opponent, the game is in the balance and things can happen. Weird stuff can happen. Results can go wrong. Liverpool are conceding goals late in games and it's costing them because they have just completely and utterly failed to create any kind of buffer between them and their opponents in a way that ultimately you would expect a team of Liverpool's quality to do so. Now, that's a wider conversation on the quality of the Premier League. Maybe yes, maybe no. But it's really striking to me how close everybody else has looked to Liverpool in terms of level and how they've managed to keep them really close by in games within a goal. And then five teams have stung them in that sense. So it speaks volumes about Liverpool's performance levels. And that's why Arne Slot is under pressure. That's why seemingly I think about half the fan base would like to see him leave at the end of the season, if not more than half the fan base.
Feels like that.
They don't put games away. They completely lack control. And then Arne Slot steps out in the post-match and he lets everyone know exactly how to beat Liverpool, which is just driving people mad. You know, he points out all of their tactical flaws. I saw one of the editors at The Guardian recently said, Arne Slot does his post-matches and he speaks about Liverpool like a podcaster. He assesses and diagnoses the issues like a podcaster in a post-match video.
And like so many podcasts this year, sort of rails against 25, 26 Premier League football as well. And you just got to adapt. Yeah. You've got to adapt in their position.
Just on one thing, one of the things I've noticed about Liverpool this year is as the season has gone on, obviously we do a Ranks Patreon. And at the start of the season, Liverpool, we have a lot of Liverpool fans who would speak sort of week in, week out. We'd get a couple and whether they'd be angry or happy, it didn't really matter, but we were getting those comments. In recent weeks, they've just dried up.
Really,
and I think that apathy. That really feels like a bit of a killer apathy, because I think particularly for Liverpool, and this is a point I've made on Ranks before, but particularly with Liverpool, I think the connection between manager and club is really, really important. And this year, it feels like any connection that was built last year with Arne Slot, you know, off the back of that title winning side has dissipated so fast. I think that's one of the main reasons you can give for a potential change of manager in the summer.
Agreed, yeah. Also, I just want to bring up his rotation policy or lack of rotation policy, because it looks to me like for the second year running, it's hurting the team. And this is the sort of thing that, okay, look, we don't have access to the medical records. We don't know exactly what's going on here. But we do think we know that by about March last season, Slot's inability to rotate the team really hurt them later on. And their lead at the top of the table started to get eaten up a little bit. And had they not made that quick start, things may have been different. So that's fine. I'm not criticising anybody for starting fast and then tapering off. My criticism was it may have cost them in the Champions League. It probably did. There was the game in between the two PSG games where they played Southampton at home and he played like 10 of 11 starters. I was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And this year, I don't think I can see any growth from Slot in this area. He has 11 players over 2,000 minutes in all competitions. Just 11 players. Van Dijk, for what it's worth, is on 3,500. And Salah is at the bottom of that at 2,300. Those 11 players have all got 25 or more starts. And then the drop-off to the 12th player is Curtis Jones. It's actually 7 games, starts fewer. So we're already down to 18 games in all competitions, all 4 competitions for Curtis Jones, which I don't think is enough games, point blank. And then if he hasn't underused Jones, then he's definitely underused Federico Chiesa,
for sure,
who's had a huge impact off the bench multiple times but just cannot really get into this team. I think he's underused Rio, And I think that's quite troubling as well, because Liverpool want good young players to come to the club, and they want players to go through the ranks. And if Slot doesn't want to use them and only uses Cody Gakpo, then it becomes a bit of a problem. I'd even go as far as to say that I think he's done Mabadashvili a little bit dirty. Mm. I think he should have been given the cup game against Brighton. He should have been given the Karabakh 6-0 in the Champions League on match day 8. Slot has his guys and he doesn't move from them. And it hurts the team, not in the first couple of months of the season, but I think by the time we get to March, it starts to crop up again.
100%. And you look at where they need to strengthen in the summer. Is Wataru Endo there next year? They need to sign a central midfielder. They've got Jeremy Jacquet arriving. He's now ruled out for the entire season at Rennes with a shoulder injury. That's not ideal, having already agreed to sign him in January. They need a couple of wingers, you'd have thought, as well, because the backup to Cody Gakpo, who's not been as... Well, I think a lot of Gakpo's deficiencies last year were covered up by the fact he could rotate with Luis Diaz, and they were quite different style of players. And Cody Gakpo's finishing last year, often in at that back post as Salah played that ball inside, was just on point. But to have Gakpo playing so much football this year, and it just doesn't feel like his game's been clicking. But Salah's the one to focus on, to be totally honest. I mean, just a few stats on him. 29 league goals and 18 assists last year. No one expected him to back that up. But the drop-off, absolutely mad. So he's on 11 goals and assists in 21 league games. For a normal player, that's not too bad. Salah is not a normal player. There are 35 Premier League players that have scored more goals than him. He's only scored 5. He scored the same amount of league goals as Casemiro and Martin Zubimendi. And we're in March. This is Mo Salah. The fewest he's ever scored in a league season is 18. He's on track to score 6.5. And I know that's not a real number, but 6-7 league goals for Mo Salah. Unthinkable going into Jack's doing the 6-7.
Yeah, of course he is.
I set it up.
I refrained.
I'm too old for that.
I refrained.
But the point is, and the point still stands, that Mo Salah... it just isn't in the position to be throwing his weight around in terms of that sort of strike in December. And I don't think Liverpool fans on current basis will really rue his departure on current form. And look, he's been an amazing servant. He's been probably the outstanding right winger in Premier League history, at least in terms of longevity, right up there with Cristiano Ronaldo. But it's just not a disaster if he leaves this summer, especially as he's only got 1 year left on his contract. I don't think you want to miss out on the chance to get £25-30 million from Saudi Arabia right now.
No, you probably don't. And so Salah is one of a few, I think, big topics for Liverpool to address in the summer. They're still probably going to need to look at the centre-back/right-back situation, like so many injuries over on the right. Leone should be back. Jacquet should be in. If they can extend Konate, they do technically have 4 centre-backs, so maybe it's not, but...
Do you want to extend Konate?
Look, when he's good, he's good.
Yeah, it's been a while, though.
When he's good... he had a little renaissance recently, I think, but then he can obviously then dip off again. He wasn't great on Tuesday, but who was?
No. He really backed his pace against Rodrigo Gomes, didn't he? And then just didn't get there.
Yeah, he used to get there. Look. It's what it is.
Also, I do get your point. He's a peak age centre-back. Like, losing him on a free is probably not totally ideal financially.
No, not...
Yeah. I think he has been fine since the turn of the year.
Yeah, I think he's
been grand. But also, if he wants to leave and, you know, he's not going to sign a contract, then you've got to deal with that situation, right?
Yes. Do you think he might go to Real Madrid? Should we talk about Real Madrid?
He's not going to go to Real Madrid, but he'll go somewhere. But Real Madrid's a fascinating situation as well, Sam, because they've had a really bad last couple of weeks. And it felt like the start under Arbeloa was dreadful. Then actually they had quite a decent run in La Liga, but to have lost their last 2 league games after 8 straight wins against Osasuna and Getafe, they're now 4 points behind Barcelona. Barcelona have really started to click in the last 10 days or so. I think they scored 10 goals in their last 3 games. I don't know whether you guys saw the highlights or watched their second leg against Atletico Madrid last night as we record this. One of their best performances of the season. I thought they were absolutely phenomenal. And watching them all fall to the turf at the end of that, having failed to overturn a 4-0 first leg deficit.
They were close, though.
Very close. They had a lot of chances and completely steamrolled at Atleti, who just really didn't turn up whatsoever. And watching Simeone look so delighted at the final whistle, looking at all the Atleti players celebrating. And look, I do get it. They've won, I think, 1 Copa del Rey under Simeone. So they're within their rights to celebrate getting to a final. But it felt a bit false after that level of domination.
Well, you know, Rafinha put a black and white photo on Instagram. That's the mood. But anyway, that's Barcelona.
Yes.
Real Madrid, I mean, so final whistle goes on Monday against Getafe. They've lost 1-0. The whistles are very loud. And Real Madrid expect wins. They are a results-oriented football club, perhaps more than any other club on earth. They are results-oriented, and they really don't care about how the win comes. It just needs to come. And the last couple of weeks, dropping those games against Osasuna and Getafe, not a good look. The goal that Getafe scored, by the way, if you haven't seen it, just quickly look it up. He won't hit a better ball than that in his life. Nice. On a stage like that, he will not hit a better ball. What a wonderful volley. I'm going to try it next Monday. So if the podcast is cancelled because I need a hip replacement, you know what happened.
We'll be live from the hospital.
I'm going to give it a go. I was going to try the Szoboszlai 30-yard free kick the other week.
Nice.
The one that he smashed in off the outside of his foot.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I lined up to do it, I realised I was going to probably knock out someone in the wall because it's not. I can't aim it properly, so I shouldn't really be trying these things. But we'll see how.
You can bend the size of your leg, if you can get that leg in that bend, you know, it could curl pretty dramatically.
You never know. Off the back of the Getafe defeat, Rodrigo, torn ACL and torn meniscus.
You never like to see that in March in a World Cup year.
I kid you not, I saw a report that said that Rodrigo has torn his ACL and torn his meniscus and is in danger of missing the World Cup. I thought that's a very optimistic way of phrasing that.
Yeah, he's out.
He's out for the rest of the year, unfortunately.
Like a November jobby, maybe.
And Mbappe has been injured for the last 10 days or so.
Yeah.
His injury is, whenever Mbappe gets injured, I feel like we have to deal with a bit of mystery. It's never straightforward, with Kylian. The reporting
Real Madrid injuries as a whole.
But I think even when he was back at PSG, I think injury reporting around Mbappe was always quite weird, quite shadowy. And it's happening again. I've seen the report that it's a matter of weeks. I've seen the report that it's months. I've seen the report that they'd like him to play next week. I've seen a report that they want to be cautious and don't want to put any risk involved. But we'll see how that happens, because ultimately they're playing Man City in the Champions League round of 16 next week. So, okay, are you going to be that patient or are you totally desperate? We'll see. But Mbappe's missed the last two games. That one of those was a win over Benfica, in which they were rubbish, actually rubbish. And one was obviously a loss to Getafe. In the Benfica game, Benfica got 30 touches inside Madrid's penalty box. About 1.6 XG. I watched Benfica just rip them to shreds, and Jack and I were talking after the game about how good Rafa Silva was, but just generally Benfica just tore through the middle of them. They don't look like a very good team, and Jack, I saw a clip of you on Instagram the other day. You must have been on the radio, as you often are these days, saying that you'd be pretty stunned if this Real Madrid can win the Champions League, and I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's always a slightly hot take, right? It shouldn't be a hot take given the way that Real Madrid are playing right now, but you never feel like you should write them off in the Champions League, because we've seen weird things before and we'll undoubtedly see weird things again. But yeah, I mean, I'd be stunned if you're watching this iteration of Real Madrid. And look, I think heads are going in the camp as well. And one of the things that you can obviously address if you want from the game on Monday is Antonio Rudiger's completely losing his head and kneeing someone in the head.
That was horrible.
Like, it was horrendous, like a genuinely horrendous thing to watch, thing to witness. And Diego Rico came out afterwards and said, if I'd done that to a Real Madrid player, I would have got a 10-game ban. And it's hard to disagree with him. Now, look, that's not me, you know, going in at Real Madrid, but like, there is an element of this where I think players in this camp are starting to get frustrated, and you're starting to see it on the pitch. You know, you saw, you know, Vinicius remonstrating with the crowd. We saw what Rudiger did. And like, there just doesn't seem like there's any real cohesion amongst this group right now. They've got injuries themselves, right? Like, we're talking about Mbappe there. We talk about the defensive line all season long. Jude Bellingham's been missing for long periods. But I mean, does it come down to the crux of what we were speaking about last year, was that, have you replaced Toni Kroos yet?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, ongoing topic for sure. But it does feel like Kroos and Modric, the leadership that they bring, as well as the playing sort of quality, obvious playing quality. I mean, the discipline problems this year. So I was looking into it. Only Elche and Barcelona have received fewer than Real Madrid's 47 yellow cards, which is kind of classic for a side like Real Madrid that are dominating the vast majority of the ball. But only Real Oviedo, Girona and Rayo Vallecano, all of which currently rank 13th or below, have received more than Real Madrid's 6 red cards, which is actually a lot for the league. It seems like a lot of people are losing their heads in La Liga this year.
Yeah, it is.
But 6 red cards for 4 sides or more. But either way, Real Madrid are in there. Barcelona, for context, have received 2. So Real Madrid are continually shooting themselves in the foot. I would say about quite a few of those red cards, they've often come right at the end of games for dissent and just sort of losing their heads in the kind of maelstrom.
I remember one, Fran Garcia got a second yellow, didn't he, for dissent. And the camera was on Xabi Alonso as it was happening and he mouthed something which was to the effect of, are you effing kidding me? Yeah. But it is a problem. It does speak to a lack of maturity in the camp or a lack of discipline, whatever it might be. And we say the same things about Chelsea, who are on 7 Premier League red cards, and I think 9 in all competition, comps, yeah. Which is an absolutely disgraceful tally. Like, a disgraceful tally to have 9 red cards by March.
Is there something in that? Is there something in the idea that you spoke about it right at the start, Sam, where winning is a DNA from Real Madrid's perspective? It kind of doesn't matter how they get there. I think in the modern iteration of Chelsea, we've seen something similar erupt, right? Like, when Chelsea aren't winning trophies, even if they're not playing particularly well, what is the club ethos, etc.? And when that winning goes down the pan, as it has done for Real Madrid for obviously less time here, we're talking 18 months, it's not that long, and most clubs would kill for 18 months to be their longest club, you know, trophy drought. I totally buy that. But when it all comes apart at the seams, feeling like, and it doesn't feel like there's a direction or things aren't going to plan with a project, to teams who are in this situation where winning is the kind of ethos, maybe feel it more from a playing perspective.
I think for sure. I think unserious organisations often breed quite unserious playing styles. And obviously the decision to fire Xabi Alonso, despite his issues with Vinicius Jr., from reports, from what Jude Bellingham said, the vast majority of that squad got along with Xabi Alonso pretty well. And we talked about it at the time. What does it mean for Real Madrid going forward? That they, I think Ancelotti and vibes is a bit overhyped, but effectively got rid of a lower tactical instruction guy and brought in Xabi Alonso, the guy to revolutionise their side and their playing philosophy and bring them into the modern era in terms of pressing and sort of structured with and without the ball. And they got rid of him at the first opportunity and hired Arbeloa, who had, 15 games of Castilla football under his belt?
And they've dropped back into their ways, their Carlo ways, which is what they were trying to escape in the first place. We talked about it at the time. Is this white flag, is it being raised on the idea of a tactical system? Kind of, yeah, because the pressing's dropped off. They sit in a 4-4-2 sort of mid or deeper block. I actually don't like the fact that often Camavinga plays left mid and Goulaire plays in the centre. I'm not keen on that. And I know that on the ball, it moves and drifts, and that allows Camavinga to drop inside, Valverde to go wide, Goulaire to get up and support the striker. Fine. But off the ball, and when they play really good opponents, they are going to spend a bit of time just sitting there. It doesn't feel good. Mm. You know, watching Benfica just rip through their centre, can't help but feel like that might have been a bit harder if the players were in their sort of correct positions on paper, so to speak. So I don't really like the shape or the system that they've settled back into here. And without any intensity to their defending, they feel like they can be picked off far too easily, especially considering, like, if that defensive line that they played against Benfica, or the one they're often having to wheel out here, which is often patched up together because of injuries, and it includes Raul Asensio, for example,
very up and down.
I would try to protect that defensive line a bit more. Mm-hmm. With Camavinga and Tchouaméni, and not have Ard Gullit in front of Raul Asensio. Like, I'd be really scared of that.
Arbeloa did do this for a slight time. He did start to play the two of them together, and actually they had a couple of wins. I think it was against Valencia, where they basically gave away no chances. They were really, really compact, and they didn't create loads either. But I remember talking, you know, about it and thinking, actually, in bigger games, that might make sense. And we haven't really seen it wheeled out since. And they have played in some of these games where they've been being torn apart, and you're not seeing it, and you're thinking, well, that doesn't really add up in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Valencia game, and they won it late, as they have done a lot of games, and they didn't give up any chances, but they didn't create too much in terms of clear-cut chances until like the very end. So it feels like when you play like that, you have to wear teams down. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mbappe was around for that game as well, which helps. Are they just shrinking into their shells a little bit without Mbappe right now? But are many of these players being platformed well, and have they just kind of sunk back into their old ways? I suspect the answer is yes. They lost the Supercopa, they're out of the Copa del Rey, and they lost to Albacete in the second division. They're now 4 points back from Barcelona, despite the fact that a couple of weeks ago they were in pole position. Real Madrid's weird. Every 2 weeks, this picture changes completely. But it's very hard to believe that this season is going to end well for them right now.
Well, it could get ugly pretty quickly as well, because that Mbappe over-reliance, if he is being rushed back for Man City, and he was playing with an injury for a good couple of months, according to reports, at least the information that was available as well. If he's rushed back and takes a step backwards. Also, he needs to be careful about the World Cup this summer. He obviously wants to be fit for that. I'd be quite reluctant to rush back if I was him, but he's obviously scored a crazy amount of goals, 38 in all competitions. He's scored 23 in La Liga. Their next top scorer in La Liga is Vinicius Junior on 9, most of which have come in the last few months. And then after that, it's Gonzalo Garcia and Bellingham on 4. So it really is the two-man show in terms of going forward. They've had so many injuries at the back, as we've already touched on.
Two-man show is generous. It's a one-man show, mostly. Yeah. It really is.
And then their fixture list, they play Celta Vigo on Friday. Celta Vigo beat them in December, which was their first victory against them, I was looking up, since January 2017. Then it's Man City next week. Man City have already beaten them quite comfortably in the Champions League with one of their best performances in the first part of the season, let's say. Then Elche at home, that's fairly winnable. Man City away, Atletico Madrid at home before the end of March. That's a really hellish fixture list for a side that are battling with morale, that are trying to get to grips with the new manager's instructions, that have a number of injuries as well. I mean, the Man City tie doesn't feel like as tantalizing as it normally would, mainly because I think we've seen it so many times now, but also it just feels very uneven.
I look at this Real Madrid team, the way they've played the last couple of weeks, the way they have defended, been cut through, and I look at City and I do think that
strength and depth at City as well.
That doesn't bode well for Madrid at all. I will remind you about what I said last week, which was fixture lists aren't real. So don't worry.
Sam hates fixtures. It's the new theme.
Don't worry about the fixtures. The fixtures are irrelevant.
Let's see.
Right. Should we move on to our final club?
Yes, let's do it.
It's Newcastle United, specifically requested by Dougie Critchley.
No. I mean, kind of, a little bit. It is enjoyable to stick the knife into a rival. And Newcastle have given us quite a lot of material to do that in the last few weeks. So this is shot before their game against Man United. Maybe they beat Man United, but even if they do, it's been a really troubling run. So as it stands, they are 13th going into tonight's game. They are 4 points below Sunderland in 11th. They have scored 40 goals this season. They've conceded 42, so they have a negative goal difference for a side playing in the Champions League. They are currently, as we record this, 12 points off fifth, and they are 11 from relegation. So they're closer to relegation than the Champions League spots right now. They've only won one of their last six games, and that was against Spurs, who everyone has agreed are rubbish. They've lost the other five. Those defeats have come against Villa, Liverpool, Brentford, who are all in pretty good form. Actually, aside from Liverpool, Man City and Everton as well. They've lost three consecutive home games for the first time since February 2021. That year, they finished 12th under Steve Bruce. It has been a while since Newcastle have been this poor. What have you kind of spotted in their recent performances, Sam? What's going on with the Toonami?
Okay, so this is weird. This is another one of those situations where you're seeing a lot of things that you haven't seen for a long time. So you talk about the consecutive losses at home. Newcastle under Eddie Howe in this era, phenomenal at home. Great intensity, great goal scoring potential, results and performances. St. James's Park has just been a nightmare until seemingly now. Mm-hmm. Defensively, they've been really solid for the most part under Eddie Howe. They've invested really heavily into the defence. The year before last, the year before that, maybe when they qualified for the Champions League the first time, so 3 years ago, their defensive record was absolutely sensational. Now they've capitulated. So clearly this has all been coming. And Bruno Guimarães' injury is definitely a big part of this.
Huge.
Their record with him in the team is phenomenal. I remember it being wheeled out ahead of the fact that he was going to miss the Villa game, that it was something along the lines of they've played 44 games with him in the team in the last 44 games and they've lost twice.
And really? That's insane.
And then he missed the Villa game and they lost. And then he came back. He sort of was clearly injured and like tried to be part of the squad for the PSG game,
well,
I think.
He's out until April as well.
And now he's out for a while and they just keep losing. So if you ever want an example of how important one single player is, Bruno Guimarães, Newcastle United, heartbeat and more. So that's obviously, that there's a part for that. The defence is kind of caving in because they have only one centre-back who appears to be able to stay fit and play and has two legs. And it's Malik Chow. And they've run him into the ground so badly because all the other ones can't be relied upon that Malik Chow is now playing quite poorly compared to his standards a couple of months ago. Lewis Hall, I think, has been playing slightly injured for about 4 months, but they don't have anyone to call upon. Tino Livramento's on his third injury of the season. They don't have proper fullbacks. They don't have proper centre-back cover. Nick Pope started making mistakes. Bruno's not in the team. Joel Linton got an injury. It's just from the midfield back, it's just stacked up. And I think I'll pass to you for the attack.
Yeah, it's really not great for the attack. I mean, just quickly on final defensive stat, they've conceded 23 goals at home this season in the top flight. Only Wolves and West Ham have shipped more. That's just not something we associated with Newcastle whatsoever. And even at the weekend against Everton, they came back into the game twice. On both occasions, they conceded again within 2 minutes. What a morale sapper. Mm. And also had to watch Jordan Pickford, a former Sunderland player, pull out an unbelievable save in the last minute as well. But yeah, let's talk on the attack, because Nick Voltimada has come in for a lot of stick over the last couple of months, and I think it's pretty unfair. I think he's...
Big Nick stick. Yeah.
Big Nick stick. He started like an absolute rocket, but was scoring goals that anyone that watched him at Stuttgart would know was not really his style.
He was scoring goals he wasn't meant to score.
Yeah.
We knew it.
He's not a target man, and he was scoring some unbelievable headers, and I just thought, let's not get carried away.
Well, I thought he'd learn to be a target man over the summer, and I was very worried.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, we've got a world beater on our hands here. But
now he's playing more as a 10. They've tried Anthony Gordon up top. They've tried Joen Wissa, who's been absolutely terrible. But Nick Voltimada at the weekend against Everton, 14 touches. He's playing as a number 10, failed to have a shot or create a chance. He scored 3 goals in his last 25 games. Seems to be running out of steam. They obviously couldn't play Wissa for so long. Anthony Gordon's form in the Champions League versus the Premier League is one of the starkest I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's totally bizarre. Kylian Mbappe,
like double the amount of goals in the Champions League as the Premier League or something.
Yeah, Kylian Mbappe is the only player in the Champions League to score more than his 10 goals.
He's now
Newcastle's all-time top goal scorer in the competition.
What?
Above Alan Shearer.
Oh my God.
It's insane. Off, what, 2 years in the Champions League? But his conversion rate, yeah, his conversion rate in the Premier League, so he scored 3 goals from 38 shots, so an 8% conversion rate. In the Champions League, he's on 29% conversion rate.
Mm.
That's bizarre. He just loves the lights. It's mental. But you've mentioned the injuries as well. But so much of that attack, you look at, and we've talked about it for so long with Newcastle, I feel like a stuck record as well. I don't think there's enough point of difference in that midfield. Well, now they're trying to play Nick Voltimada there, but there's not really a natural creator when those legs aren't working. And on the right-hand side, Anthony Elanga, I think is too stylistically similar to Jacob Murphy. They needed, I think, ideally a left-footed right winger, someone like a Kudus or a Madueke.
Well, Elanga's a left-footed right winger.
But yeah, the problem is he's just really bad.
Well, yeah, but he's also just like a gas man. Like they need more creativity for when these helter-skelter games aren't going their way and there's so much blood and thunder and it doesn't quite come off. I just think they're so predictable.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Eddie Howe seems to be very specific in the players that he likes to recruit. And
he was head of recruitment last summer.
And I'm not going to criticise him for prioritising certain things. Like, I think he likes homegrown players. I think he likes speed and intensity. And I think he likes good guys. Like, you'll very rarely find, I think, in an Eddie Howe dressing room, any sort of like controversial characters or anyone that seems to be like a good boy.
Mm.
And I know Joel Linton is a bit on the thuggish side, but he predates Eddie Howe. So he doesn't really count. But again, a general lack of variety in that sense too. But for the most part with the attack, you know, we can sit here and say that we all knew that Joen Wissa for 50 million was a terrible idea. They've been very unlucky with the fact that he immediately got injured for 3 months like that, and it was on international duty with DR Congo. So that's just really unfortunate. But
they had to sign 2 forwards in a week as well.
Well, hang on. No, they did. They really didn't. Like,
well, if they'd let Isak go earlier and, yeah.
It's all connected.
Yeah.
It's all contextual. At the end of the day, they're not the only party in this. However, they could have sped things up a little bit. They also could have just had a better shortlist, you know. But anyway, and they did try and sign Hugo Ekitike, to be fair, before he got poached. But we know that Wissa was a bad idea at 50 mil. And yes, it's unlucky that he got injured. But you create a rod for your own back when you've decided to drop that much money on a guy who has to work right now.
30 in September.
So he turned 29 just after he joined. And that puts an obvious clock on how quickly Johan Wissen needs to succeed. And so you are at the mercy of something like that. And that's your fault for signing a player at that stage of his career or in that situation. Elanga, 52 million, has been terrible. They were chasing him for three windows and it's like they didn't have a plan for him. I really don't understand this. Voltomada, I expected him to slow down a bit because it is tough to maintain what he was maintaining in a new league, in a new environment for a long, long time. And Jacob Ramsey for 40 million has grown into the season okay.
He's been decent.
Currently looking like the most successful of the four 40 million plus deals that they struck for the midfield or the attack.
Which Newcastle don't spend money.
Which isn't great, no. Obviously. But is it another case of Newcastle struggling to play, kind of as you say, with enough variety when they can't go hellfire every 3.5 days because the Champions League prevents you from playing at that full whack intensity? I was just seeing that again. Has Eddie Howe still not learnt that lesson?
Is it time then to move on? Like, I like Eddie Howe a lot, but I think that there is a level here where we've seen the same thing happening over and over again. We've seen Newcastle excellent when they have a week between games and they're able to refresh. I also wonder if Eddie Howe's system can work without three in the middle, and therefore where do you play Voltomada, because you're not playing him as a nine. You want someone in front of him to come over, or you actually play him as a very, very withdrawn nine and you play two wingers who are going to get in behind, like Stuttgart did with Jamie Leveling, right?
Well, but they could with Gordon,
sure,
and Elanga,
but
they don't play like that.
So that's not how Newcastle operate. I think that there is a lot of goodwill for Eddie Howe. And rightly so, because he's worked his way up and he's worked in good situations that he's done well with. He's improved most teams he's gone into. But I also think that banging your head against the wall the same time over and over and over again and not seeing any changes is a bit of a sign of madness. And I was going to kind of take it to a wrap point, which was, do you think any of these three managers are in charge of their clubs next year? Because I think that with this one, this feels like the most emotional one that we're talking about. But I also am starting to really genuinely believe that Newcastle might need to move on and bring in someone who is going to utilise some of these signings in a better way.
I think there's a fair chunk of the Newcastle United fan base who would be fine with Eddie Howe moving on. That's the vibe I'm getting from social media these days. There are some that are quite loud about it, some that are quite quietly resigned to it, I think. He's a popular figure. He's done very well, so you shouldn't really be baying for his head. But ultimately, I think I've seen some people going, "Oh, I think it might be time." And he said at the start of the season, I saw his quotes. He was asked about the grind of the Champions League, the intensity issues. He said, "We've taken stock. We've learned our lessons. We'll certainly be better at it. I don't see the evidence." And he can point to a few things that have gone against him, 100%. Every single manager, every club that we talked about, each of their managers can do so. But you've got to battle your way out of it. And the reality is that for the three clubs, and this includes Newcastle, very demanding ownership, very demanding presidents. Like, they're 13th in the league. They're probably not going to win the Champions League. They're at real risk of not qualifying back for Europe at all. And they're the richest club in the world. So at a certain point, you don't have to overthink it when you assess it, right?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very valid point. I also think that there's a real possibility that if Man United don't want to go for Michael Carrick, they look around the Premier League, because I think they've been burnt when they've looked outside the Premier League in recent years with Amorim and Ten Hag. And I think Eddie Howe is a far more attractive offer for Man United than an Andoni Iraola. I think he's a better offer than Glasner. I think he's a better offer than Marco Silva. I think he's probably more realistic than Unai Emery. I also think he's potentially a better fit for Man United's style and DNA than an Unai Emery as well, which they're also bloody obsessed with. So I think Eddie Howe would be a really interesting person to sound out if you're Man United. And people might say, is Man United a significant step up from Newcastle? Yes, it really still is. Like, A, the finances that they have available on a year-on-year, despite being in massive debt, are just completely different from Newcastle because of the revenues. And I think Eddie Howe would jump at the chance because, unless he's going to get the Liverpool job or Man City job at some stage, Man United is probably the most attractive club to work for in the Premier League still, given their history and prestige in the game. So I think he'd be an amazing fit there. In terms of whether any of the managers are there next season, I wonder whether the fact that we came back to at the start of the podcast, the Diogo Jota factor saves Arne Slot, and whether transfer committee also look at the kind of mistakes that they made and whether they just say, look, we should have got you that centre-back. We should have strengthened a deeper squad, because I don't think this is all on Arne Slot.
No, of course it's not.
As bad, it's as, definitely it's been, not, as, it, bad as it's been.
But it's also, Xabi Alonso is just sitting there on the sideline. If you have a club legend sitting on the sideline, maybe play the youngster that the fans are screaming out for. Like, maybe drop your favourites here and there and utilise your rotation policy. It's not always rocket science, right? Like, sometimes it's just do the things that people want to see, because if they then backfire, you can then be like, well, you know, I was being screamed at left, right and centre to try this. I've tried it. You've seen the results. Now I can go back to it.
Yeah.
Like, I just
although
feel
if you
like
then do
not...
it and results don't pick up, then you look kind of weak-willed.
I think he's appeasing. I think he's not doing any of the appeasing. And I think if Alonso wasn't sitting on the sidelines, I think Arne Slot would probably be given the benefit of the doubt. I think the fact that he is changes the picture completely.
Let's see what happens with Pep. I think Alonso might end up at Man City.
Yeah, we'll see. I think Slot will be done at the end of the season. I think they'll move on. I don't think, unless they win the Champions League, but even I don't think they're going to do that.
Goodwill, a lot of these, by the way, like with all three of them, I think to a degree, it's thank you so much for what you achieved. Thank you for your service in our Arbeloa's
not Arbeloa.
Yeah, but that's thank you for your service and thanks for stepping in when the club needed you.
Yeah,
I don't think they go with, you know, I don't think any of them are sacked outright. Do you know what I mean? It's more kind of like have decided to part ways.
Yeah.
But I think we could see it with all of them.
Yeah, 100%. That's an interesting framing, actually, Jack. I hadn't really considered that, but. Very likely situation here, I think, for me, is that the three of them are going, or at least two. Like, Arbeloa is not going to make it through. I don't think Slot will make it through. Howe has the best chance, but I'm starting to become very, very sceptical. I think the results, the league position, and a potential lack of European football next season will make the decision for the ownership. So I think they will be quite ruthless.
Yeah. I there's also the element of, like, Man City really wanted Livramento last summer. I don't know whether those injuries mean that they don't anymore. Mm. Does Bruno Guimaraes want to stay at Newcastle for another year? Like,
I actually think Bruno might stay there for the rest of his life.
I don't know.
He seems to love it.
He's a Champions League contender, year on year title contending level player. I think he can do better than Newcastle, and that's not just the Sunderland fan saying.
I mean, I think if a club were to spend £100 million on a centre midfielder, which it's starting to look like someone's going to do it, and we always talk about Wharton and Anderson and Belaba, you'd be much more comfortable spending that 100 million on Bruno Guimaraes than anybody that we've just mentioned.
Yeah, like, I suppose he is about 5 years older.
He
than
is,
as well.
But he is a phenomenal.
He's ready to go.
He's a phenomenal footballer.
Six, eight.
Yeah, difficult. But these three clubs, their seasons are
teetering on the edge of disaster.
Is that the catchy something YouTube like title you're going to go for? You should see.
Doom.
You should see the YouTube title pictures Doogie sent me earlier. Disgraceful stuff.
Negativity sells, man. Negativity sells.
So does positivity sometimes.
It does, yeah. We should all be, yeah, particularly with everything going on in the world, a bit more positivity. But not this week. It's about the doom.
Yeah, not this week, obviously. Or last week.
maybe we should spin it from a positive title next week.
Well, if there's anything in football that's positive next week, we can talk about it. I promise you that.
Let's do it.
Cool. Doogie, thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Samuel.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you same time next week.